WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. According to the U.S. National Library of Medicine, West Nile virus was first identified in 1937 in Uganda in eastern Africa. It was first discovered in the United States in the summer of 1999 in New York. Since then, the virus has spread throughout the country. The Centers for Disease Control says that since 1999, more than 30,000 people in this country have been reported as getting sick with West Nile virus. As of September 4th of this year, 48 states have reported West Nile infections in people, birds, or mosquitoes, with a total of 1,993 cases of West Nile virus in people, including 87 deaths, one more yesterday, that in our area. And that is the highest number of cases reported to the CDC through the first week in September since West Nile virus was first detected in this country in 1999. This year also brought the first known case to Mecklenburg County. It presented in Elizabeth Leland, longtime writer for the Charlotte Observer. Her experience with the virus was chronicled by Charlotte Observer health reporter Karen Garlow. She joins us in our studio for the hour. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good to see you. Also with us by phone is Dr. Steve Keener, or Stephen Keener, who happens to be Mecklenburg County's health director. Welcome back to you, too.
Thank you. Well, glad to be here.
We had hoped to have Elizabeth with us, but I'm told that she, although she came down with us in late July, I think we'll get her full story, is still pretty sick, right?
She is. She's been at home. She's been out of work since August 10th. And although she told me yesterday she is improving, which I was glad to hear, she didn't really feel up to this. She's never certain when she gets up in the morning, you know, how she's going to feel. There are lingering headaches and problems with sensitivity to light and nausea that comes from that. So she just wasn't sure she could make that. So I'll be her surrogate here.
You know, Americans have heard about West Nile virus for years without giving it much thought. I heard two stories about how it got here. The one I just said, 1999, New York. Then I heard that it was brought over here by mosquitoes or mosquito larvae that were incubating in water set in tires that came over here to the port of Houston, Texas. Do we know how it got here, Doctor?
The story that I've always heard was that it came in probably on a ship coming from either Israel or the Middle East somewhere to the port of New York, because that's actually 1999 where we saw the outbreak start was in New York and New Jersey and the Northeast. And then every year after that, you could kind of, if you look at a map for incidents in each year, you can kind of see it spreading southward and eastward across the whole country. And by 2004, 2005, you know, it reached the West Coast and basically was prevalent over the entire U.S.
Now, the lifespan of a mosquito is relatively short. So how does it spread? How does it go from the port of New York all through the South and down through the East? How is it transmitted?
Okay, so this is kind of a complex situation, and I'm not a veterinarian, but I'm going to do the best I can. The life cycle of this virus really depends more on the mosquitoes and birds. Mostly the birds are of the corvidae birds, the crows, ravens, jays, those types of birds. And people will probably recall back in 2003, 2004, when we were concerned about this, that literally crows were dropping out of the sky, and you know, you could find these on the street and in people's yards. So the viral amplification actually occurs in the crows. That is, the mosquitoes bite the birds, and the virus amplifies. It reproduces many thousands of times inside the crows, and then more mosquitoes bite those crows, and they are reinfected or infected with the virus. And so that's how the life cycle is. It's a crow or a bird to mosquito life cycle. And then Humans and horses are what we call, they're kind of, you know, they're not primary hosts. They're kind of accidental hosts. We can't serve in the same way that birds do as a vector. That is, people cannot spread it to other people, and I don't believe that people can give it to mosquitoes. So when it ends up in a human, we're kind of like a dead end host, and it doesn't the infection doesn't go any further. But it may be different kinds of mosquitoes that bite these birds, and then bite humans and horses. And so you can see that with the population of birds, and it's estimated there's about 30 different species of mosquitoes that can actually help propagate this. You can see that it wouldn't take too long for it to spread widely.
Now, you're the health writer, or one of the, I don't know how many health writers the Observer has, but you are the health writer.
Right.
Karen, and you've been writing about this since 1999.
Exactly,
What brought it to your attention, and why was it of interest before we had cases here in Mecklenburg County, or before we knew that this thing was spreading like wildfire through the country?
Well, nationally, of course, you know, we knew that it was showing up in New York, and I guess it wasn't maybe of great interest to us right at the beginning, but as the years went by, as Dr. Keener said, we started having dead birds here in Mecklenburg County. I remember writing about one couple that found a dead bird in the South Park area. You know, that was a story, you know, that day. And the health department was encouraging people to call about dead birds and to, you know, not touch them, but to report them.
Is it dangerous to touch them? Because
well,
it could have been
if the birds were infected.
Really?
And yes, and you touched them, it could have been. So that you were encouraged not to touch them, okay, but to report them. And then the health department would collect them and have them tested. Mm-hmm. So in those early years, as he said, we were looking at West Nile and the birds. It wasn't until 2002 that we had the first human case in North Carolina in humans. Yeah, I said, and then we were paying attention, right, to it very closely. And frankly, there were a couple that I did know the name of the person who had it, but in one case I remember it was a very mild case, so we didn't go into detail about it. And sometimes we would know the age, or if there was a health problem that contributed to someone getting sicker because, right, of the infection. Because, as you know, most people don't get sick from West Nile.
What exactly is West Nile virus, doctor? I mean, and what does it do to the body?
Well, it's an interesting little virus. It acts like any number of viruses that are spread by mosquitoes that attack the brain and nervous system. It's from a different family of viruses. It's more similar to yellow fever or the Japanese encephalitis virus, kind of that family. But what it does is it gets in the bloodstream, it goes to the brain, and actually in most cases of infection, it's so mild that there are not even any symptoms. It's only in probably 20% of people that people will get some symptoms, and that's just kind of like a mild viral type infection. You know, you may have fever and chills and kind of the achy wakies, and you know, after a week or 10 days it kind of goes away. In about 1 in 150 people or so, then there will be more serious neurological consequences, and you get those same type of fever and chills and achy wakies, plus you can get symptoms of meningitis or encephalitis. Now let me break those terms down. The meninges they're kind of the coverings, the protective coverings of the brain and the spinal cord, and inside these coverings is the spinal fluid and the brain. So the brain actually rests inside these coverings in a bit of fluid that provides a kind of a shock absorber for it, and also nutrients for the brain. So the meninges are the coverings. Meningitis is inflammation of the coverings of the brain. Encephalitis refers to infection of the brain tissue itself. Mm. So meningitis and encephalitis, they're separate, but they're both both relating to the brain and the spinal cord. So the symptoms of meningitis are more like headaches, sensitivity to light, stiff neck, fever, vomiting, those types of things. Encephalitis is more, you don't get those symptoms, but you get focal neurological symptoms or generalized muscle weakness, paralysis, changes in the level of consciousness. That is, people can get kind of somnolent or stuporous or even comatose, and then can wake up a little bit and go back to sleep a little bit. They can get either paralysis of the entire body, partial or full, or parts of the body. And they can also get neurological changes, changes in memory, or, you know, sometimes some really strange types of symptoms.
So are you,
that's kind of what it does.
So are you saying this is like a combination of the two, encephalitis and meningitis?
It can be one or the other, or it can be kind of a mixture of both, depending on...
And can it go back and forth?
Generally would not go back and forth.
So this means if encephalitis would indicate to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that this virus is able to pass through, what is it called, the
blood-brain barrier.
Blood-brain barrier. It can go through
correct.
That.
Yes, viruses are incredibly small, and they really can go anywhere.
Hmm. So the mosquitoes don't get infected. They don't get affected by this, do they? They just carry it.
They just carry it.
So they bring blood out of infected birds. How do the birds get infected? Where does it start?
That's like asking, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg.
Okay.
But the mosquitoes get infected from the birds, and the birds get infected from the mosquitoes, and that's how the life cycle keeps going.
And then we get infected from the mosquitoes that have bitten the birds who have been infected. I'm curious about this because I think one of you said that we don't think that humans can transmit the virus to uninfected mosquitoes, but mosquitoes who are infected can transmit it to us.
That's correct.
If transmission of this virus happens through a mosquito, why aren't all viruses? Why isn't the HIV virus transmitted through a mosquito?
Well, it's a really good question, and the answer is because it depends on the part of the life cycle of the virus that must occur in the mosquito or the bird or whatever other animal is involved. And HIV did not evolve being a vector-borne disease through mosquitoes. So the HIV virus does not have a part of its life cycle in a mosquito, whereas these viruses like equine encephalitis and St. Louis encephalitis and La Crosse encephalitis and West Nile actually do. Part of their life cycle depends on a living part in the mosquito.
So scientists believe that we could see further outbreaks of this into mid-October, and when cold weather finally hits us, this crop of mosquitoes, I suppose, dies or goes into hibernation. Does that mean that next year's crop starts from ground zero, that these mosquitoes will have to bite infected birds all over again, and we start the cycle anew? Is that how it works?
Yes, for the most part. I don't know that in the South, anyway, that 100% of the mosquitoes get killed,
right?
Although they do have a finite, lifespan, and it's not very long. But to the extent that we have a cold winter and a dry spring, we will have less problem with this next year.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more on West Nile virus and on one particular case of it in our area. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the College Foundation of North Carolina, offering the North Carolina 529 College Savings Plan, one of many services, helping families plan, apply, and pay for college. cfnc.org/NC529. And Heath Springs Residential Care Center, providing long-term assisted living for the elderly. New Alzheimer's care unit opening in 2013. Reservations now available. Details at 803-273-3255. 3227. Well, the economy is still languishing around the country, and North Carolina lags the nation. And since the recession began, we've been checking in quarterly with Dr. John Connaughton, director of the North Carolina Economic Forecast, to track trends and get our bearings. He joins us again. And in addition to talking about the economy at large, we'll spend some time tomorrow looking at the possible economic impact of the DNC. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, with the election just 8 weeks away, federal and state courts have handed down conflicting decisions on voter ID, early voting, and provisional ballots. What the decisions could mean for the outcome of the 2012 election.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks, here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHEI. Mike Collins. Dr. Stephen Keener is with us, health director of Mecklenburg County, and Karen Garlow, a health writer for the Charlotte Observer. And we're talking about West Nile virus, which has presented itself liberally here in Mecklenburg County. And we have at least four known cases.
Five, I think.
Five now.
In the state.
Several deaths, I think two in North Carolina, one in South Carolina, and one very well-known person who has it, which we'll talk about in a second. As you've said, Doctor, this virus can lead to death, but it doesn't always. And in fact, some people have no symptoms. Others get fairly sick and recover. Do we know why?
Well, the natural history of any disease depends on the strength of the host, that is the person who's ill, and that would be, you know, how robust that person's immune system is, how they have been exposed to other illnesses in the past and have survived, and also the strength or the virulence of the pathogen that is infecting that person, and then there are environmental factors as well. So it's really hard to predict exactly what's going to happen to a person who is infected with West Nile, although, you know, history and statistics show us that people that are older than 50 years old tend to have a more difficult time with it than younger people do.
If the pathogen is weaker, does that mean there are different strains of this virus, or does it simply mean that viruses can be weak or strong depending because they exhibit their own personality traits?
Weaker, or perhaps there are more people in the population that have been exposed to it before. Remember, I said that only 20% get symptoms. That means 80% are infected and don't get symptoms. That means that they are able to defeat the organism, and their immune system is built up and strengthened because of it. And that means that they have immunity against being infected again, and they wouldn't get ill. So there are also different strains of the virus. There are mutations that occur. In fact, there has been some talk about the fact that we seem to be having a resurgence of West Nile this year. Could be due to changes in the genetic makeup of the virus, and that would be similar to what happens in the influenza virus from year to year. Although there's no evidence that it occurs as rapidly or as frequently in West Nile as it does in influenza.
Now, I know that, Karen, you folks at the newspaper have been reporting this nationally, but the largest number of cases this year have been in Texas. Texas has also been in severe drought much of this summer. How can we have this kind of incredibly strong number of cases in Texas, many leading to deaths of a mosquito-borne disease in an area that is parched? Not conducive to having mosquitoes. Do we understand that? Maybe you don't know. I'm just asking.
I'm not an expert in this, but yesterday I did talk to Dennis Salmon, who used to be the mosquito control expert for Mecklenburg County, and he had spoken with an medical entomologist that used to be with the state office, and he suggested that we usually think of mosquito breeding grounds and with water, you know, but that extreme drought and extreme heat might also combine to accelerate the strength of the virus, and so that when there was, you know, when there is a little water, that the mosquitoes become, you know, even hyper-driven, you know, to breed and spread the virus. That is not my area of expertise, but he was suggesting that, and I thought that was an interesting idea.
So, doctor, let's go through the symptoms here, because as you say, some people don't really have any symptoms. Some people have very mild symptoms, and other people have severe reactions to this virus. What are the symptoms?
Well, I think that, you know, the common ones are fever and chills, headache, sensitivity to light. You know, when you're around light. Sometimes people will get nausea, vomiting, and then stiff neck, muscle aches. You know, kind of like what I call the achy wakies. And then this other large area of changes in neurological status, which can be changes in the level of consciousness or muscle weakness, paralysis, partial or full, and then changes in mood or memory lapses, difficulty with thinking and computing and things like that. There are you know, many different ways that it can present with neurological symptoms.
Can you have any of these symptoms, no matter what, whether you're having a mild reaction or a strong reaction to this virus, or do they build in intensity? In other words, do you start with fever and chills and move in the end at the highest level of this to muscle weakness and convulsions and tremors and things like that?
Yeah, I think the latter is a better description. There are symptoms that are pretty universal, and that would be like a fever, fever and chills, and then the next ones would be the weakness and nausea and vomiting and headache, and then so far down the line.
Is this easy to diagnose? Because these symptoms sound like they could be symptoms of a lot of different problems.
It's not really the top choice on physicians, you know, diagnostic possibility list. Although here in North Carolina, we have a number of other encephalitides that are also mosquito-borne, such as Eastern equine encephalitis and La Crosse encephalitis. So physicians are pretty savvy here when they see these types of things, and the state's really made it kind of easy because there's an arbovirus panel that can be ordered. Most of these diseases are diagnosed by what we call serology, meaning that it's a blood sample that measures antibodies to these particular viruses. There's not any way we can look at the virus directly. Culturing the virus is not very reliable. It's not a good test. Sometimes, PCR test is actually a DNA test is used, but it takes longer. It's more expensive. So the serological tests are generally what are used, and so physicians will get a panel, and sometimes it's really difficult to tease out just from symptoms whether it's West Nile or one of these other types of viral encephalitis.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but there is no cure for this. There's no you don't prescribe a pill and it's over in 10 days. What do you do?
Yeah, that's correct, and that's correct for the majority of viral infections. There's not an antibiotic like you can give for bacterial infections. So,
but let's be clear about that, because people go to the doctor when they have these symptoms and they want an antibiotic because they think that's going to cure everything, and antibiotics have no effect on viruses.
As a general rule, that's true. There are some specific drugs that do have activity against viruses. We have one for herpes virus. We have one for hepatitis A virus. But for the most part, that is true. So in answer to your question, the treatment is supportive. So, if somebody is having difficulty with neurological symptoms, for example, then And sometimes they are in intensive care, sometimes just in regular hospital care. And you do the same thing for that patient as you would for a patient that had, meningitis from another cause, except, you know, there's no specific medication that you can give.
Now, normally when we hear about cases cropping up in the news, we hear about them anonymously because of HIPAA and other requirements of medical privacy. But Elizabeth Leland, who has been a longtime writer for The Observer, is a name and face we can put on this disease. And you have been writing, Karen, about Elizabeth's struggles with this. When did she first know something was wrong?
She told me that it was on August 3rd. She was working. She didn't stop working right away, but she said one night, every joint in my body was screaming in pain, and I couldn't sleep, ankles, knees, wrists, even my toes and my fingers, she said. During the next week, she got a sore throat and a low-grade fever, and so she finally went to her primary care doctor, who drew some blood tests, and she went home, and over the weekend, it got worse. She got what she called a blinding headache and had some nausea and vomiting. And she and her husband went to the emergency room, and they did a lung x-ray and some other tests and sent her home with pain medicine and nausea medicine. And the next day, her fever went even higher to 103, and she went back to the ER. And then I think it was that a test showed that she did have meningitis, and they admitted her for 5 days. And she's as she described it, you know, she didn't really know a lot of what was going on in those days. You know, foggy and sick, and took 4 days before her fever broke. And during that time, as you said, it's kind of hard to diagnose this because the symptoms can be symptoms of many other things. And so the doctors ruled out Lyme disease. They were thinking about that for a while, which is a tick-borne disease, and some other tick-borne diseases. And it wasn't until August 23rd. So this started on August 3rd. It was August 23rd when the test came back positive for West Nile.
If it started on August 3rd, when does she think she was bitten by the mosquito?
The health officials had talked to her about what she had been doing, and she had been out of town in Rhode Island on vacation. And at one point, I think it got confused that people thought she got it out of town, but she really thinks, and I think others do too, that it was when she was here at home in Charlotte. She said at the end of July, she was doing a lot of gardening work after they had been on vacation and back in town, and the garden was out of control. And she said she might have spent 20 hours over a few days in her yard. And she said, I got ravaged by mosquitoes to the point where I started wearing long pants and long sleeves outside, but it was probably too late.
Let me ask this, doctor. Are your chances of getting this virus or a stronger case of the virus increased by multiple bites by the same mosquito or multiple bites by several infected mosquitoes as opposed to simply being bitten once by one mosquito?
That's a good question, and you know, I have to admit I don't know the answer.
Does anybody?
I don't know.
Somebody probably does.
Because she mentioned getting ravaged by mosquitoes. I know that if I walk out in the backyard toward the fence, I will get attacked.
It seems logical, if you're stung by a swarm of bees, you're obviously in worse shape than if you get stung by one. So if you had a large viral load, from places all over your body, it seems logical, but I don't know whether that's actually true.
Well, let me bring a fellow who's already been referenced in this conversation into the conversation. Dennis Salmon is a retired Mecklenburg County Health Department person, and he's been on this program. And one of the things we talked about were pests, and among those pests were mosquitoes. Do you know the answer to that question, Dennis? Are your chances of getting infected by this or any other virus greater if you're bitten by more than one mosquito carrying the disease as opposed to one mosquito biting you one time?
I would say probably Dr. Keener's exactly on the button, so to speak. If just by the logic, a good example is rabies. If you were bitten one time or exposed one time to a rabid raccoon or to a raccoon that might be rabid, and not all raccoons necessarily might have rabies, but if you got exposed to 10 of them, I would say your potential odds for having exposure would go up greatly. So if you had a lot of activity in a community, and Dallas County, Texas would be an excellent example with 1,000-plus human cases, if there's that much of a load of virus out in a quote-unquote wildlife ecology, your odds are probably considerably better if you're out, you know, every day for 30 straight days versus one time in a blue moon.
We, Garen told me off the air that you have told her, I think you told her, that there are mosquitoes. We have a lot of mosquitoes in Mecklenburg County that do not bite birds. If that's the case, then would that explain why our number of cases of this virus are lower, because the birds pass the disease on to the mosquito, and the mosquito then passes it on to us? But if they're not biting the mosquitoes, the chances are lower.
Well, West Nile, after 10-plus years of either working directly with it, or I can't help my intellectual curiosity. I just keep following this. And I would say that probably the biggest thing that you would talk or think about is how much virus is really out there in a particular community, in a particular population. And in our case, there may be lots of virus in our bird populations, and for whatever reason, they're no longer affecting birds as dramatically as they did previously. Now, does that immediately mean that because birds aren't dying that we're not going to get as much exposure? Possibly. You know, I've had people ask us, even back in 2003 when we were getting 20 cases and Illinois was getting 800, what's different about Illinois other than Chicago and it's north of Charlotte or north of North Carolina? Mosquito species and host birds are different in Illinois than they are in North Carolina. There's not an easy explanation. Just there's a lot of complexities in this particular virus, and even after this disease, and even after 13 years, there's more that we don't know than we do.
Well, doctor, when the disease runs its course in just a couple of days, is that because the person's immune system has effectively attacked it, destroyed it, put it down, or is it because these folks contracted a weaker strain of the virus, or is it because of something else?
It could be any of those possibilities, or all of them, or any combination of them.
But if you get it, you can't get it again, is that right? A mosquito bite essentially inoculates you from ever getting it again?
That is true in theory. It's certainly the reason why we give vaccinations to our children and to adults. And generally having the infection is the best protection if you survive. Best protection against getting infected again. That's for viruses. That's not for bacteria.
That leads me to the obvious question, and I only have 30 seconds here, and that is there a vaccine in the works for this, or one available today that will protect us in the future from this?
Not to my knowledge, and probably, you know, if I were guessing, I would say the reason is because that even though this can be a serious illness, it's still, you know, even at its most, several, you know, 1,000 or more cases in the country, and we have 350 million people. So the cost of vaccinating everybody would be prohibitive.
Okay. We have to take a break. We're going to come back with Karen Garlow, Dr. Stephen Keener, and Dennis Sullivan in just a moment, talking about West Nile virus. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and McCall Center for Visual Art, who welcomes the public to an opening reception. America Now, politically charged works by DNC artists in residence, 6 to 9 p.m., September 21st. Details at mccallcenter.org. With the election just 8 weeks away, federal and state courts have handed down conflicting decisions on voter ID, early voting, and provisional ballots. What the decisions could mean for the outcome of the 2012 presidential election, the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation about West Nile virus, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or WFAE.org, and then click on Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Sometimes it seems like the news industry is one big runaway train, headed way too fast, destination unknown. I'm Melissa Block. At All Things Considered, we plan our daily voyage carefully and take the time to see the important sights along the way. Don't worry, we'll still get you where you need to go. All Things Considered from NPR News. Enjoy the journey.
Weekday afternoons from 4 till 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking about West Nile virus, which has presented itself in Mecklenburg County. And one person in particular, we put a name and face to it because she writes for the Charlotte Observer, Elizabeth Leland, who is too ill to be with us this morning still, and she got this. The first symptoms presented on August 3rd. But Karen Garlow with the Observer, a health writer there, has been writing about Elizabeth's struggles with this for quite a while. And she's with us in the studio. Dr. Stephen Keener is also here, health director of Mecklenburg County. He joins us by phone, and we've invited Dennis Solomon to join us as well because he's a retired Mecklenburg County Health Department person and a mosquito expert. He's been on the show to talk about pests in the past. I'm curious, Dennis, can you tell by looking at a mosquito that they are likely carriers? Do certain species of mosquitoes with identifiable markings carry this more often than not, or do they themselves look ill in some way, if they have the disease?
You know, I never thought about when we look at them under a microscope, and we used to identify, and still do, identify mosquitoes by species. That's any part of a good pest control program. but I never thought to look to per se to see if there was a particular marking. Seriously, there are. God sakes, there are in excess of probably several dozen mosquitoes in the United States that, since this was introduced into the U.S. in 99, have been found to have the virus. Now, having the virus or having been exposed to the virus doesn't mean that all those different mosquito species are able to transmit the virus. North Carolina, there are, I think, 61, 62 different species of mosquitoes in the state of North Carolina. And yes, I do have a life other than worrying about how many different species of mosquitoes are. But there are really a very small number of those that are what I would call excellent vectors and transmitters of the virus from birds back to birds, or if incidental hosts such as people or horses come in. One particular genus group of mosquitoes is what we call Culex, C-U-L-E-X. And Culex mosquitoes, there are four or five different types of Culex mosquitoes, few more than that in North Carolina, of which we have them here in Mecklenburg County. They are excellent vectors for the virus. They also are prolific bird biters, whether you're in Texas or whether you're in New York or whether you're in the South. Many Culex mosquitoes they like to feed on birds. Some of that may have to do with the fact that birds are in trees, and these mosquitoes may be more likely in some cases to be found more likely in near trees, that type of thing. But whatever has occurred evolutionally, these mosquitoes very much like to bite on birds. But birds are not the only thing. In some areas of the country, they're primarily bird feeders and may not ever even bite on a mammal like a horse or a human. Whereas in other places, in the U.S., those same mosquito species can be very prolific bird biters.
Is the speed of diagnosis at all important, Dr. Keener? In other words, if you are able to diagnose this in a person more quickly than not, are there chances of having a less severe form of this or being cured of this greater, or does it matter?
I don't think it makes that much difference. I think, you know, if you knew that's what it was, then you would be able to kind of zero in on the most effective means of making a patient feel more comfortable and supporting them and giving them the care they need. And you wouldn't be, you know, doing a lot of diagnostic tests shots or giving treatment that if you knew it was West Nile, then it would not be needed. But I think the disease course is going to be the disease course for the most part.
And if fundamentally, once you're bitten, these symptoms present as either encephalitis or meningitis or some combination thereof, does it matter that it's West Nile virus? Would it just not be the same treatment that you would give to anybody who had meningitis or encephalitis?
No, that's exactly right. It would be the same treatment that you would use with anybody that had viral meningitis or viral encephalitis.
But you can tell through are there tests, either blood tests or urine tests or other bodily fluid tests that will give an indication that, yes, this person has West Nile virus
yes,
in their system?
The serological test, the blood test
okay.
that I mentioned earlier,
okay.
do distinguish between the different kinds of viral encephalitis.
Now, the virus arrived here in 1999, but the peak year, Karen, seems to have been 2003. That year there were, I think, nearly 10,000 infections around the country and 64 deaths. It has declined almost every year with slight ups and downs. It looks like the economy. Last year there were 712 infections and 43 deaths. This year it's up. Do we understand why there was this great decline from 2003, but then yearly fluctuations up and down? Does anybody know the answer to that, Karen? Do you know the answer to that?
Well, again, the other guys might be more expert at this, but, you know, once a virus is in a population, you know, people are infected and they become immune. And so one would suspect that there would be fewer cases. What's interesting?
So next year should be a good year for Texas?
Well, last year, they didn't have very many.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, it's very unpredictable, as both Dr. Keener and Dennis Salmon have said. So it's hard to tell. One thing Dennis pointed out to me, which is an interesting thing, is that this year we've had about 2,000 cases so far total in the United States. In 2003, we had, like you said, 10,000. And in 2006, it went up again to 4,200, mm-hmm. about that. You know, so it went up and down a little bit. In North Carolina, in that 2003 year, we had 24 cases and 2 deaths, whereas now, so far this year, we have 5 cases and 2 deaths.
Patricia in Charlotte wants to know if you can tell by the bite if anything has been passed on. I guess by the bite site, does it look different? Does it feel different? Does it itch more, less? Is it bigger bump? Anybody know the answer to that? Dennis?
No, you can't. You cannot go by what the bite looks like at all.
Okay.
Some people get bit by mosquitoes and they don't even know it.
Michael from Charlotte called in, couldn't hold, says, is it true that mosquitoes are attracted to the carbon dioxide that we emit? And what about fabric softener sheets as a repellent? He has heard that that works.
I'll let Dennis answer that, but I've never heard of the carbon dioxide. I have heard that they are attracted to scents, either good scents or bad scents.
Dennis?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of different factors that can be attractive to mosquitoes, but just a quick and dirty, simplistic list. Number one, they're definitely attracted to heat. If they sense, and to a lesser extent, movement, so those two physical elements, if they're looking for a blood meal to take from a dog or a bird or a person, so sort of heat and movement, that's one. Two, they actually are somewhat attracted to elevated levels of carbon dioxide. When we used to trap mosquitoes in what are called light traps, we actually would use dry ice. And what in a mosquito makes them more attracted to that, I really can't tell you. But, yes, they are certainly elevated somewhat. They are attracted definitely to carbon dioxide to the extreme that, you know, there's carbon dioxide outside, but that it's elevated amounts. But and then lastly, they're very chemosensitive. There are a variety of things. Dr. Keener was talking about scents, and that's absolutely true. And there are some very specific things. The lactic acid that's sort of in our skin has been cited as if there's been studies where they have found, looking at the chemical composition of human skin, and there are certain facets of that mosquitoes, a lot of species will just absolutely hone in on. So, but my experience over the years was everybody is uniquely different to how attractive they are to mosquitoes.
Let me take a chance here and take a call. We sometimes have a problem with this, but let's just see what happens. Neil in Charlotte.
Welcome. You're on the air. Good morning, Mike. This is the third program I've been able to listen to on NPR regarding this issue, West Nile virus. On the first, there was a Houston epidemiologist who cited a study indicating that after 10 years, 50% of the population had insufficient antibodies in their system to grant them immunity or protection. And then subsequent to that, I've heard your guest today and another one who had cited that there was lifelong immunity. So I guess I'd ask the guest to discuss that and take my comments off the air.
Okay. I don't know which one of you to take that, but go ahead.
So I think the question, if I understand it, was does this grant lifelong immunity? And I think to the extent that anything does, the answer is probably yes. The reason why they can say that there's 10-year immunity is because that's when they did the study. That's when they measured it. So, you know, I guess in order to say that there would be lifelong immunity, then they would have to test everybody at the end of their life. But we do know that antibody levels do gradually decrease over the life of a person unless there's another infection, and then that tends to boost the antibody response in the same way that we get booster shots for tetanus and diphtheria. So I believe what the caller heard was correct.
Melissa called in and wanted to know, is it worth it to get the blood test after the fact, after you've recovered from what you suspect was West Nile? Is it worth it to get it so that you'll know in the future that you probably won't get it again?
Oh,
I wouldn't even know how to answer that.
Yeah, I suppose it would be of an academic interest, but, you know, it's certainly not relevant to patient care, since the patient would already be recovered.
Since the disease can cause swelling of the brain, is lasting brain damage a possibility here, Doctor?
Now, that is a very good question, and it does relate to the patient that we've been discussing, Ms. Leland. And first of all, let me just say that I'm happy that she's recovering and that she seems to be improving. And I'm sorry that she had a difficult time with this, but there are studies that show that some of these symptoms do tend to hang around for quite a while, just as they are in Ms. Leland, and whether or not it goes back to complete normal in 100% of cases, I think it may be unknown, but it's certainly reasonable to assume that there could be, you know, some little increment of decreased functioning in some way or another. But, you know, these things are hard to predict when we're dealing with the nervous system.
Because Karen Elizabeth reports, as you said, photophobia, extreme sensitivity to light right now. And she also is foggy on occasion. Is that because of swelling of the brain or spinal cord or something else that's going on there? Do you know?
Well, it is obviously a symptom of meningitis, and as Dr. Keener said, and she says that comes and goes. It's kind of an odd thing. You know, she said when she came home from the hospital, she couldn't even walk by herself, but today she's been able to get up and walk around.
Would that be the case, Doctor, with just other cases of meningitis that are not caused by West Nile?
Yes, although with bacterial meningitis, obviously we have the antibiotics that do, in fact, kill the bacteria that causes it. So the recovery can be much quicker.
I also understand.
In that case, it does make a big difference when it's diagnosed.
I also understand that in a minority of cases, permanent muscle weakness can result. Why? Do we understand why and why it can't be reversed?
That would just be a function of damage to either the peripheral nerves or the nerve where those peripheral nerves connect in the central nervous system. It's just probably the more likely case.
One of our callers, Steve, called in and wanted to know, do we know how it was originally introduced in the into the environment? We kind of covered this at the very beginning of the show. We don't know how it was originally introduced into the environment around the world, but in this country, we think it came in on a ship in 1999 to the port of New York, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
And Dr. Keener earlier mentioned tires, and just a quick comment on that. Used truck tire or just used tire casings arriving in the United States actually in quote-unquote mosquito history does have an entry point. It's basically how that nasty Asian tiger mosquito likely got into the United States, but that was 14, 15 years prior to the introduction of West Nile.
So in Texas, they just engaged in aerial spraying to bring down the mosquito population because they have a significantly higher incidence of this virus than anywhere else in the country. What has Mecklenburg County done either this year or in the past? What should it be doing now? Would it be wise for us to spray?
Well, I'll comment quickly. In years past, Mecklenburg County primarily their program or their control processes normally did not involve applying pesticides to the atmosphere for the purpose of killing adult mosquitoes. A lot of times it's just call it fogging or call it adulticiding. And frankly, it was not a curative process. Our program was much more of a preventative process and also trying to kill mosquitoes when they were in larval stages, not as biting adults. That said, there are a lot of municipalities in the United States, and not even taking Texas into consideration or Dallas County.
So I'm running short on time. Dennis. So in other words, it's up to us to spray ourselves and to empty garden containers of water and things like that. Get rid of the pesting breeding grounds. Do area blood banks test for West Nile? Is there a possibility that the blood supply is infected in any way, Dr. Keener?
I am not aware that they test for West Nile or any other arboviral infection. And I would just like to add in terms of prevention that people should avoid being outside to the extent they can at dusk and dawn, which are the mosquito feeding time.
Okay, Dr. Stephen Keener, Elizabeth Leland, Karen Garlow, and Dennis Salvo.